Reading, I think, like Original Sin, it's the original joy for me. And writing is just something that has come along with it. You know, even sometimes now, a great gift of writing is that it's made me a more voracious reader. I want to read more because I write. So I think reading gives me so much.
It's Shelf Life. In this episode, people on the margins in the strange, fable-like stories of the great Eudora Welty, a love triangle murder mystery in William Maxwell's haunting So Long, See You Tomorrow, and the dislocated lives of first and second generation immigrants in New York and Texas in the debut short story collection of my guest, the author Ada Jean. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche says investigators are moving quickly to gather evidence about the suspected gunman who tried to storm the White House Correspondents' Dinner last night. President Trump was rushed from the ballroom after Secret Service agents subdued the suspect. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche told CBS News' Face the Nation that the suspect in custody is not cooperating with investigators. Blanche did not name the individual, but two sources familiar with the matter tell NPR the suspect is 31-year-old Cole Allen from Torrance, California. Blanche says investigators are combing through evidence they've gathered so far, including from the suspect's electronic devices. Based on preliminary information, Blanche says the suspect is believed to have traveled by train from Los Angeles to Chicago and then on to Washington, D.C., where he had a room at the Hilton Hotel where the correspondence dinner was taking place. Investigators believe the suspect was targeting Trump administration officials, but Blanche says they are still looking into a potential motive. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
A White House source tells NPR investigators found the suspect had attended a No Kings rally at some point and had posted anti-Trump and anti-Christian writing on social media accounts. It's unclear what will happen next on ending the war in Iran. President Trump had planned to send U.S. envoys to Pakistan yesterday, but canceled after the Iranian foreign minister met with Pakistani officials and left Islamabad before the U.S. representatives could arrive. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
Trump told reporters on Saturday that Iran had, quote, offered a lot but not enough. And so Trump said the trip would be a waste of a trip. So the fate of these talks is still unknown and the end really isn't in sight yet.
NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben. Meanwhile, Iran has virtually shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and U.S. ships are blockading the waterway, which carries about one-fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas shipments. 6 in 10 U.S. adults say they favor abortion rights. That's according to a new survey from the Public Religion Research Institute, or PRRI. NPR's Jason Rose reports.
Support for abortion rights has risen among some religious groups and declined among others, according to the survey. 70% of Black Protestants now favor abortion being legal in all or most cases. That's up from 56% in 2010. Meanwhile, favorability has dropped slightly among mainline Protestants and white Catholics, but majorities of both groups still favor abortion rights overall. The four religious groups without majority support are Hispanic Protestants, Latter-day Saints, white evangelical Protestants, and Jehovah's Witnesses. PRRI surveyed more than 22,000 people from all 50 states. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. A car bomb exploded outside a police station in Belfast last night. Police say there were no injuries. A peace agreement in 1998 had ended decades of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland, but the police occasionally come under attack by nationalist militants opposed to Britain's rule in the region. Kenyan runner Sebastian Sawe smashed a world record today at the London Marathon. NPR's Amy Held reports he's the first person to officially break the two-hour mark.
Are we going sub two? We might be going sub two here on the streets of London. It's never happened.
Sebastian Sawe made it happen, finishing at 1 hour, 59 minutes, 30 seconds, more than a minute faster than the previous record.
This is one of the greatest human achievements we've ever
had. To the excitement of the BBC announcer and the crowds lining the London streets.
Sebastian Sawe from Kenya is in the record books, not just here today, forever.
Sawi is the first ever sub-2-hour finisher under official race conditions.
I'm feeling good. I'm so happy. It's a day to remember.
The 31-year-old spoke to the BBC.
Reaching the finishing line, I saw the time, and I was so excited to see running a world record today.
The runner-up from Ethiopia also came in under 2 hours. Amy Held, NPR News.
In women's basketball, Indiana Fever star Caitlin Clark was back on the court last night, playing her first WNBA game in 9 months due to injuries. She scored the first basket of the game and finished with 7 points, 4 assists, and 3 rebounds. It was just a preseason game, but Clark said it felt good. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Reading, I think, like Original Sin, it's the original joy for me. and writing is just something that has come along with it. You know, even sometimes now, a great gift of writing is that it's made me a more voracious reader. I want to read more because I write.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Loss, longing, and melancholy dominate the strange and sometimes mordantly funny short stories of Eudora Welty, a writer who was able to sum up the absurdities of life without sacrificing her compassion for the characters that populate her fiction. I'll be talking about Welty's debut 1941 collection, A Curtain of Green, with the writer Ada Zhong, whose debut collection, The Sorrows of Others, has just been published in paperback, an honoree of the 5 Under 35 Award of the National Book Foundation. Zhong writes beautiful portraits of first and second generation Chinese immigrants dealing with cultural and geographical dislocation, women on the threshold of adulthood, intergenerational misunderstanding, and the horrors of mid-century American cooking. Her characters reveal as much about themselves in what they say as in what they don't. Zhong has said, lies say a lot about people. What we choose to lie about can be incredibly telling. Getting your characters to lie or hide the truth is a sure way to get to know them. We'll also encounter the unreliable narrator at the heart of William Maxwell's celebrated short novel, So Long, See You Tomorrow, the other book that Zhong has chosen to talk about today. Ada, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk to you about your new collection of short stories and these two wonderful pieces of fiction you've chosen for today.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm so excited and happy to be here talking about two of my favorite books.
Well, I know you've just returned from China, so if you need a nap at any time, let me know.
Yes.
You've chosen two wonderful books, the very slim So Long, See You Tomorrow by William Maxwell, first published in the New Yorker magazine in 1979, and the debut collection of short stories by the great Mississippi writer Eudora Welty, A Curtain of Green. She was a bit of a revelation to me. I'd never read any Eudora Welty. You are a short story writer yourself. Your near perfect collection, The Sorrows of Others, is suffused with a kind of wry, tender compassion for the everyday struggles that so many people kind of live with, our shortcomings, as well as the kind of experiences of first and second generation immigrants from China. So I'm curious to ask what connections or relationships you see between Eudora Welty, who was so kind of centered in the particular world of Mississippi and very grounded in that world, and your own work, which is in a sense about people who have kind of drifted from home, had to sort of take their roots and replant them elsewhere.
Yeah, I think what fascinates me about Eudora Welty is that she never left Mississippi And yet she is really able to see it and to see the people there accurately, which is to say, in all of their vulgarity at times, but also compassionately in their goodness. One of the front-facing pages of my book, I included the quote from Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin, "You don't have a home until you leave it. And then when you have left it, you never can go back." Well, Welty kind of defies that idea because she really remained a country girl, you know, her whole life. She had a very rich social life. You know, she didn't run off to New York like a lot of writers do, like I did. She stayed where she was, and she said she couldn't imagine a quote unquote writer's life. She wouldn't know what that meant. And I thought what was hilarious was that her friends would see that she'd published a new story or a book, and they would say, "Why, Eudora, when did you have the time to write?" Because she's just busy having like a normal social life in a southern town. I think that's very fascinating and kind of brave to write about a place in which you currently live, to not write about it at a distance, but to write about it while you're planted there. I just love her attention to setting and to Mississippi and to the people in Mississippi. We'll get into it as we talk about some of her specific stories, but I think it's very, very evident in The Whistle. You know, there are only two lines of dialogue in that whole story. It is a short story, a very short, short story. There are two characters, and I think they each speak one time at the very, very end. You know, it's a story that's about silence, and she's able to make that silence so alive and allow that silence to say so much because she is letting the setting do so much of that work to lift that story off the ground. She's just so observant. She's so attentive to detail. You know, her writing never really feels like it has an agenda. It never feels to me like she's trying to tell readers anything. They all just feel completely self-made. I don't know if that's the right word, but I don't feel the presence of the author. I just feel like these stories just existed all the time. And it took someone as observant and honest as Miss Eudora Welty to share them with readers.
That's so interesting, that framing of her work as a writer who has no agenda. And I wonder how important that is to you as a writer, but also something else you mentioned, which is the silence in her stories, because I feel silence is very much a part of the world of some of the characters that populate the sorrows of others.
Yeah, I think that what fiction does well, that it does better than film, even theater, visual arts, is dramatizing what cannot be said, giving life to silence. To me, that is the secret trick of fiction that other forms just can't do as well. You know, a lot of my characters are pretty lonesome, even lonely, one could say, and they keep their inner lives very, very private. And from reading Welty and Maxwell, other writers I love, William Trevor, Ian Lee, Chekhov, I became really interested in pushing my characters into silence, towards silence. It became a fascination of mine, silence itself as subject, but also disturbing the limits of silence, because I'm also interested in what people do say. And I think a lot of my characters might prefer to be left alone and seek safety in solitude, in silence, but silence can also be a prison, and I wanted my characters also to reach a point where they could say something, anything, have some sort of narrative authority over their own lives, what their life has meant to them. You know, I allowed my characters to dwell in their silence, but ultimately I wanted the story to push my characters out of that.
Mm. Well, it's a wonderful read. I actually have a very hard job deciding which of the stories I love best. I think reading them is like being dropped really into the lives of others, just into the middle of someone's life story. There are always twists and surprises in your short stories. But the great success, I think, is the way you animate these emotional complexities. It feels like all the people in this collection are people you've perhaps known, or in some cases maybe inhabited. You seem to know their lives really from the inside out. I wonder how directly they correspond to your experience of the world.
You know, of course, there is some correspondence. My hot take on fiction is that all fiction is autofiction, whether you're writing about people who have a similar background to you, or you're writing about aliens on Mars. If it's coming from you, then there's some part of you in it. But, you know, I'm going to borrow from what Maxwell has said about this. His life was greatly impacted by the death of his mother when she died of the Spanish influenza. And the death of a young boy's mother appears in four of his books. And, you know, he's very open that this has been the obsession of his that he's had to write into. But this was in his Art of Fiction interview in the Paris Review. He talks about how it's really his imagination that makes it a story and makes it not autobiography. You know, imagination does so much of that work of giving, you know, truth to these stories that perhaps on fact alone, they wouldn't seem so real. And through imagination, they become not only fathomable to us, but even to other people who encounter them. And, you know, I recently went to a reading where Sigrid Nunez was speaking, and she said something that was so permissive. She said when she writes her first drafts, even though if she knows there's going to be research needed later, she works solely off of imagination, and she's shocked by how often she gets it right. Wow. Like, you know, even if she's like, I'm not sure if this town in Italy really looks like this or this really exists there, she just goes ahead and puts it down. And then later goes back and she's shocked many times by how often she gets it right. So our imaginations are very powerful. In Compromise, the last story in the book, there is a woman who is caring for her dying husband after he's left her and her children for almost two decades. And this was a story, you know, an anecdote, really, that was told to me in like two sentences by my mother about two people she knew in church. And it really challenged the limits of my imagination, because I could not believe how a woman could do the work of caretaking for somebody who had left them. It just always stayed with me. And then eventually it became this story, and it was my way of making something that was unfathomable to me fathomable, so that I could kind of come to my own understanding.
That's interesting. I wonder if you can elaborate a little on how a story begins for you, the kind of prompt like that one for Compromise, a story, an anecdote that you were told by your mother about a member of the church, the congregation. Is that a typical beginning of a imaginative exercise for you of a piece of fiction?
Compromise was a little bit special in that I heard an anecdote and later I wrote into that and made a story out of it. I guess in that case, we could say it began with story. Then I just had to figure out who these people were exactly and develop the characters and sort of fill it in. But in other cases, I don't have the story, but I have a character. In Any Good Wife, I found the wife character by seeing her baking cakes around the kitchen. And often that's how I find my characters. It's like in some mundane task that they're doing. Who is it who said, I think it's Saul Bellow, who said a writer is just a reader who has been moved to emulation. And I think this might be especially true for young writers. You know, you're reading all these great masters of the craft and you just want to try your hand at it. So when I wrote One Day, which is a very, very short, compact story in the book, I was reading a lot of Edward P. Jones and very amazed by what he's able to do in a few pages. I think I already mentioned I was reading a lot of Ian Lee, who is the writer who gave me a lot of permission to explore my own material. I had never really seen people like who look like me or my parents be the subject of great art, and reading her work made me feel like it was possible to draw from my own life. Mm.
I loved that short story, One Day, which you referenced there briefly. It's a brief story, as you say, in which a woman, Helen, recalls a visit of her father to her school to have lunch with her when she was a child and, quote, not yet weary of his kindness, which is a brutal little line. It's about a very brief encounter, really, between her father and her teacher, Miss Evans, in the school cafeteria, and seen through the eyes of a young girl who is now an older woman, and deals very obliquely with what happened to her father later. Again, not much happens, and yet everything happens. We really sort of see the world from an unformed girl's perspective in a way, but who is forming her ideas. And in some senses, her resistance to the world and the type of life she doesn't want for herself, which she sees as embodied by this teacher and in some to some extent by her father. I found it terribly sad.
Yes, I love your reading of that story. You totally get it, which is such a delight for me as a writer to hear. But yes, it is an older narrator looking back on just a very small moment in her early childhood. But I think it's that feeling of time having passed that makes that story sad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you do that very successfully in many of the stories here, the sort of juxtaposition of time. In Julia is another great example, which I found very poignant and also a little twisted in some ways. It's a sort of mean girl story, but not. It's really, again, a sort of about coming of age and
yes,
the performance we put on as young people and almost getting stuck into that performance as a defense mechanism in some ways. So we have this wonderful character, Esther, reflecting back on a relationship that ends painfully, badly, abruptly in New York. I loved that Esther had aspirations to sort of go into publishing. And then there's just this little moment halfway through the story where we realize she's gone back to Texas and is now working for a Christian publishing paper company of some kind. And you sort of realize the utter sort of poignancy of someone who had aspirations and dreams and came to New York and has now in a sense returned to her roots, to her home. She hasn't fulfilled the promise. And I feel that runs through this book. There's a sense of promise sort of unfulfilled, or maybe not promise unfulfilled. Maybe the promise wasn't there, but that life is disappointing, let's say.
Sure. Or that the promise does get fulfilled, but the reality of that promise is different from the dream of that promise. Esther does stick it out in New York for a while. She doesn't jump ship as fast as her friend, which is the reason for the dislocation, let's say, of their friendship. But living in New York is hard. It's very hard. I think about my younger self who wanted so badly to escape the small town in Texas, and she did it. But I, you know, at a certain point, I had to have a very honest, candid conversation with myself to ask, are you going to be beholden to your old dreams? Or, you know, are you going to allow yourself to change? I'm very, very, very happily living in Wisconsin these days. And if you ask me, do I miss the city? I would say not yet, you know. But if my 22-year-old self heard me say what I'm saying now, she would think I'm so uncool and that I've given up. But sorry, I have to move on.
Well, Ada, I think this is a good moment to play a short excerpt from The Sorrows of Others. This is from a story titled Any Good Wife. Let's hear it.
Eileand was at the island now, on her toes, piping icing. They were having cake for dessert, like he'd guessed. He was on his third serving of casserole and taking his time, making careful, even demarcations with his fork. Eileand had chosen a small corner piece and had finished it in under a minute. She ate fast and little these days, eager to be away from him and back in the kitchen, it seemed, though he couldn't complain. It was better than when they would sit at the table for what felt like hours, shoveling rice into their mouths with their bowls up to their faces, tearing at the pork cutlet in an effort to fill the quiet. Now the food was worse, but the atmosphere was better. They still ate in silence, but soon Ailian would become chatty again, now that she was back in the kitchen. Spreading the icing with a butter knife, she asked Ping the same question she asked every night, the same question she'd had about her hair. "Do you like it, Lao Gong?" He nodded and said dinner was delicious. "Good," she replied. Her efforts always amounted to this exchange of niceties. At the table, she pushed his used plate aside. "Devil's cake," she said, as she slid the whole thing in front of him. "With fudge icing." Tiny air bubbles were lodged into the cake's surface, this icing Americans like to put on every dessert. The sugar would no doubt give him a headache. Mooncakes and red bean buns had hinted at sweetness. Here the flavor reached its full potential. She leaned over him and began cutting a single slice. He felt like a child sitting there waiting for her. When she stood up, her breast grazed the side of his head. "You need silverware," she said. "Wait." There was a hop in her step. She was almost skipping into the kitchen. Her curls bounced as her slippers slapped the tile. After some rummaging, she came back with a clean fork. The piece of cake nearly fell over when she plated it. She used her index finger to stabilize. "Go on, take a bite," she said, sucking the icing off her finger. "You don't want any?" "I'll have some later. I want to know what you think first." She pulled a chair up close to his. "It's a cake from Betty Crocker."
"Who?"
She waved the question away. "A woman who knows all the secrets about cooking and baking." She crossed her legs energetically. "She makes being in the kitchen easier for women like me." Picking up the fork, Ping wondered exactly what type of woman Ailian was. She had been with another man during their engagement. But if he hadn't loved her, hadn't even known her then, how bad was the transgression, really? He often critiqued himself within these same parameters, asking if he was, if not necessarily the right man, then at least a good man for his wife.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, the author, Ada Zhang. And that was a short excerpt from Any Good Wife, one of the stories in the collection The Sorrows of Others by Ada, who's with me here. Ada, I found Any Good Wife both incredibly poignant and simultaneously very funny. It begins with a new Chinese immigrant to the United States, Ailian, cracking an egg into a bowl wearing her blue apron. Her hair is pulled back in a scrunchie, while Ping, her husband, watches her sort of warily from the dining room. There is a lot of melancholy here. We get a sense of Ping not really fitting in. And yet it's leavened with this humor around Ailian's determination to kind of assimilate through food, I guess. Tell me about the genesis of this particular story.
I think I sort of just found myself daydreaming about a Chinese immigrant woman cracking an egg over a bowl, starting to pour the powder from the cake mix into the bowl. And I started just wondering, you know, who is she and who is she making food for? And before I discovered writing fiction, I was considering perhaps pursuing feminist studies. When I was an undergrad at Baylor University in Texas, I was reading a lot of Betty Friedan, very, very interested in the housewife frenzy that came out of World War II, when women were sort of called back to the home after being allowed and encouraged to find work outside the home. And I started wondering what it would be like for a Chinese immigrant to, you know, discover this version of womanhood and to seriously pursue it. I think one of the difficulties of moving to a new place, of, you know, that's something specifically that immigrants deal with, is that, you know, suddenly you're in a new setting and the markers of who you were in the old country are missing. You can't really point to things and say, that's me, that's me, that's me. So I thought of Aileen as a character first. Most of the action is centered on her. She's the one making the cakes, making the casseroles, you know, sort of pushing them both into this ideal picture of American life. But then by the end of the story, I was equally fascinated by Payne. I think the characterization of him, of the husband, is really in his ability to observe his wife and to see her, really see her. See her perhaps as she can't see herself, but I think it's really marvelous that she is being seen.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode, Ada Zhang, whose new collection, The Sorrows of Others, is published in paperback this month. Ada, like you, Eudora Welty loved Chekhov. She said his stories had the sense of fate overtaking a way of life, which is a line that could well be applied to the stories in her own debut collection, A Curtain of Green, published in 1941. It's a collection of 17 stories that established her as one of the great short story writers of the 20th century. She was born in Jackson, Mississippi, where she lived for most of her life. Her home, which contains things like her favorite childhood book and her typewriter, is open to the public. And after reading this collection, I'm very tempted to book a flight and go and visit. I was really blown away by her very particular voice, one that I found suffused with the kind of landscape, the climate of Mississippi, but also that felt otherworldly, strange, sometimes gothic. But there's also real humor here, as in Welty's more famous story, When I Lived at the P.O., in which we get the hilarious musings, really, of an unreliable narrator absolutely raging on her sister, Stella Rondo. I almost imagine that as a movie by the Wayans brothers. I have many favorites. I wonder which of these stories speak most clearly to you.
Yeah, the first story I ever read by her was recommended to me by a dear teacher and a writer I love, Charles D'Ambrosio, A Worn Path. And that sort of set me off on my Eudora Welty obsession. And I just started reading as much of hers as I could, including her essays on writing, which are as good as any Virginia Woolf essay on craft. They're just so insightful and they present such a clear vision, not just writing, but also how to view the world. And the way she views the world is one that I really, really have come to appreciate. And yes, her sense of humor. I'm so glad we're getting to talk about how funny she is, because one of my personal wishes for contemporary fiction is that it did dare to be more funny sometimes. Why I Live at the P.O. is bizarre, and it's hilarious, and it does sort of defy interpretation. You know, at first, after turning the last page, you're just like, wow, that was a real romp. what is it about? I don't know about you, but when I read that story, when I read all of her stories, I really cling onto every line. Every line makes me want to read the next line. I'm never bored when I read Eudora Welty. I think that her stories are actually a lot of fun. Yes, they certainly are wise, and some of them are so sure-footed and compact that they almost read like fairy tales or something. I guess it's that quality of fate that you mentioned that she loves. It does feel that way. And I guess that is also why I feel that I turned the last page and I really am wondering, how did she do that? How did she write this story that is so confident and natural and alive? And so A Worn Path is my first introduction. And then since then, I've just been reading as much of hers as I can, and also putting off reading too much, which is something I do with writers I really love. I try not to read their entire canon so that I can go back to them when I really need a pick me up. But my personal favorite in Curtain of Green is The Whistle. I think I'm probably always impressed by a story that can accomplish so much in very few pages, but that story is just like a masterclass. It's just so good. She really outdid herself, I think, with The Whistle.
I also loved The Whistle. I mean, you said fairy tale earlier, and there is definitely a sort of Grimm's fairy tale quality to it. And I think almost a sort of Samuel Beckett type quality. You just have a sense with a bunch of these stories of these people going through the same motion day after day. In this case, a couple of tomato farmers who are in this sort of very spare environment and a freezing cold night. And the whistle is an allusion to a signal that will alert all the tomato farmers when the temperature is going to dip below freezing so that they can rush out and put quilts over their tomato plants. But yeah, I felt almost more than any other story in this collection, this showed Eudora Welty's sort of ability to explore a register that was almost spectral, kind of haunted.
Absolutely, yes.
So, Ada, let's hear The Whistle by Eudora Welty, read by my guest for this episode of Shelf Life, Ada Zhang.
In Dexter, there is a great whistle which is blown when a freeze threatens. It is known everywhere as Mr. Perkins' whistle. Now it sounded out in the clear night, blast after blast. Over the countryside, lights appeared in the windows of the farms. Men and women ran out into the fields and covered up their plants with whatever they had while Mr. Perkins' whistle blew and blew. Jason Morton was not waked up by the great whistle. On he slept, his cavernous breathing like roars coming from a hollow tree. His right hand had been thrown out. From some deepness he must have dreamed and lay stretched on the cold floor in the very center of a patch of moonlight which had moved across the room. Sarah felt herself waking. She knew that Mr. Perkins' whistle was blowing, what it meant, and that it now remained for her to get Jason and go out to the field. A soft laxity, an illusion of warmth, flowed stubbornly down her body, and for a few moments she continued to lie still. Then she was sitting up and seizing her husband by the shoulders without saying a word, rocking him back and forth. It took all her strength to wake him. He coughed, his roaring was over, and he sat up. He said nothing either, and they both sat with bent heads and listened for the whistle. After a silence, it blew again, a long rising blast. Promptly, Sarah and Jason got out of bed. They were both fully dressed because of the cold and only needed to put on their shoes. Jason lighted the lantern, and Sarah gathered the bedclothes over her arm and followed him out. Everything was white, and everything looked vast and extensive to them as they walked over the frozen field. White in a shadowed pit, abandoned from summer to summer, the old sorghum mill stood like the machine of a dream, with its long prostrate pole, its blunted axes. Stooping over the little plants, Jason and Sarah touched them and touched the earth. For their own knowledge, by their hands, they found everything to be true. The cold, the rightness of the warning, the need to act. Over the sticks set in among the plants, they laid the quilts one by one, spreading them with a slow ingenuity. Jason took off his coat and laid it over the small tender plants by the side of the house. Then he glanced at Sarah, and she reached down and pulled her dress off over her head. Her hair fell down out of its pins, and she began at once to tremble violently. The skirt was luckily long and full, and all the rest of the plants were covered by it. Then Sarah and Jason stood for a moment and stared almost idly at the field and up at the sky. There was no wind. There was only the intense whiteness of moonlight. Why did this calm cold sink into them like the teeth of a trap? They bent their shoulders and walked silently back into the house. The room was not much warmer. They had forgotten to shut the door behind them when the whistle was blowing so hard. They sat down to wait for morning. Then Jason did a rare, strange thing. There, long before morning, he poured kerosene over some kindling and struck a light to it. Squatting, they got near it. Quite gradually, they drew together and sat motionless until it all burned down. Still, Sarah did not move. Then Jason, in his underwear and long blue trousers, went out and brought in another load and the big cherry log, which of course was meant to be saved for the very last of winter. The extravagant warmth of the room had sent some kind of agitation over Sarah, like her memories of Dexter in the shipping season. She sat huddled in a long brown cotton petticoat, holding onto the string which went around the waist. Her mouse-colored hair, paler at the temples, was hanging loose down to her shoulders, like a child's, unbound for a party. She held her knees against her numb, pendulant breasts and stared into the fire, her eyes widening. On his side of the hearth, Jason watched the fire burn, too. His breath came gently, quickly, noiselessly, as though for a little time he would conceal or defend his tiredness. He lifted his arms and held out his misshapen hands to the fire. At last, every bit of wood was gone. Now the cherry log was burned to ashes. And all of a sudden, Jason was on his feet again. Of all things, he was bringing the split-bottom chair over to the hearth. He knocked it to pieces. It burned well and brightly. Sarah never said a word. She did not move. Then the kitchen table. To think that a solid, steady, four-legged table like that, that had stood some 30 years in one place, should be consumed in such a little while. Sarah stared almost greedily at the waving flames. Then when that was over, Jason and Sarah sat in the darkness where their bed had been, and it was colder than ever. The fire the kitchen table had made seemed wonderful to them, as if what they had never said and what could not be had its life too, after all. But Sarah trembled, again pressing her hard knees against her breast. In the return of winter, of the night's cold, something strange, like fright or dependency, a sensation of complete helplessness, took possession of her. All at once, without turning her head, she spoke. Jason. A silence, but only for a moment. Listen, said her husband's uncertain voice. They held very still, as before, with bent heads. Outside, as though it would exact something further from their lives, the whistle continued to blow.
We were listening there to an excerpt from the short story, The Whistle, by Eudora Welty. Ada, thank you for that. What do you think is going on in this story?
I think all great stories are, I find, very difficult to talk about. But I think maybe what is going on is, you know, these two people, they live very, very harsh lives. And the cold and the silence is, you know, you just feel how oppressive it is. And I was completely surprised when Jason starts just throwing the furniture into the fire, you know, and the dining table goes in. And after so much restraint, maybe a lifetime of restraint, they're tenant farmers and very poor. Jason just goes all out and just creates the biggest fire for him and Sarah. It's this wonderful moment. You know, you can just feel how much this warmth means to them and how, I guess, like radical their desire really to be warm, but also in a larger sense, their desire for a life that's perhaps easier than the one they've had is, and how radical it is then for Jason to chuck their entire home essentially into the fire just so that for these few moments they get to feel comfortable. It's just such a wonderful story.
I'm really struck when I read these stories by the fact that Eudora Welty so rarely writes about the wealthy or, you know, even the middle class. These characters that populate her books are really all on the margins. They're just about managing to eke out a living in many cases. Not in all of them, but generally the people in these books are not living the American dream.
Yes, that is very true. And they do exist on sort of the margins, I think, of at least the ideal of the American life, the story we're sold about the American life and the American dream. Of course, that's something I think about in my own work. Again, that dream that encourages you, pushes you to move forward. And then reality, which so rarely matches what the story, the fantasy of the dream is. And I do think it's people who exist on the margins who have a really unique point of view. They're able to, you know, make observations that people who don't exist in the margins, who are perhaps just living a more mainstream life, I suppose, wouldn't be able to make. It's often those people who are really wonderful storytellers because their vantage point is very special.
Right. At the same time, I was struck by the fact that her characters seem to take their circumstances in their stride. I mean, they're aware that life hasn't turned out too well, but they accept it. Someone compared Welty's short stories to a sort of Diane Arbus photograph, you know, the sort of combination of the strange and the grotesque. Mm. And I really loved that. I'm thinking of The Hitchhiker, which is a short story I really loved in this collection. Very sort of fever dreamish almost. A traveling salesman picks up two hikers. There's just something about the sadness, the oddballs, the brief encounters. Life seems a bit fleeting. Death is always just around the corner. I wonder how you interpreted a story like The Hitchhikers. Did that strike you as well? That sort of sense that you're in the real world, but you're also in something that feels a little off kilter.
Yes. Yes, her stories are a little eerie. You get the sense that danger is lurking. And in The Hitchhikers, I was certainly at the edge of my seat. But it's very strange, like, why she chose the traveling salesman to be their narrator. He's not one of the hitchhikers. She could have made one of them tell the story. But she often does this thing where she chooses someone in the shadows, like a bystander or a witness character. And so in that sense, I think that her stories are kind of about storytelling. The central drama takes place, but then there's someone who's watching. There's almost like a side door or something through which then the story becomes about making sense of this thing that's happening center stage. I think that she, Eudora Welty, is interested in storytelling itself as a subject. Why do we tell ourselves so many stories? Why do we write books or make art? What is it about us that makes us so hungry to weave narratives? And so I think storytelling itself is one of her obsessions.
Welty also had this illuminating anecdote where she said when she got the manuscript of her first novel back, typeset, she didn't recognize her own writing. And she actually called up the editor and said, "This isn't mine. I didn't write this." And he read out her original manuscript, and word for word, it was the same as the typeset edition. And her point was that once a piece of writing is sort of out there in the world, it takes on a different kind of life. I wondered if that resonated with you. I mean, how you felt when The Sorrows of Others was in print out there in the world of readers. If you looked at it slightly askance, as Eudora Welty did with the manuscript for her first novel.
I did. You know, but I've had some very, very lovely notes from readers who said, "I liked this," or "This really stuck with me." And every time I read that, I'm always like, what are they talking about? And then one time I just felt like, okay, wait, let me read that story again and see what they're talking about. And I read the story again, and I really did feel kind of estranged from it. I couldn't really see it anymore because I think, like so many people, you know, people have told me their interpretations. And so at that point, it really doesn't belong to you. It belongs to them. And I think ultimately that's necessary. At first, I freaked out a little bit. I wrote to another friend of mine who's a writer, and I said, "What's going on? I just don't recognize the work at all. I couldn't tell you if it's good or not." And he just said, "I think that just means you're ready to write something new." And so I think the publishing process is awful. In many ways, it feels very exposing. But one of the gifts, I think, of it is that it does kind of close that door. And then you can feel like, okay, I'm ready to find what's next for me.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. And my guest for this episode is Ada Zhong, the author of The Sorrows of Others. which is published via Public Space. We'll be back after this.
Greetings, theater fans. Tom Candela here. Coming up this week on Curtain Call, I sit down with Tanis Kowalczyk and Jess Beveridge of Farm Arts Collective. We're going to look back at the return of Lucy Joseph and how that piece evolved across two runs, and then turn our attention to their new flagship production, The Scattered Seeds of Troy. Plus, we'll preview the next chapter of Dream on the Farm and what's ahead for the rest of their season. Catch it Monday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
A former White House technology advisor says the Trump administration is strong-arming the tech industry, and that's a dire sign for the country. He points to the fight with AI firm Anthropic as an example of the nation breaking down. Dean Ball on AI policy and the future of the United States. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with Ada Zhang about two of her favorite books. She's the author of The Sorrows of Others, a collection of short stories published by a public space. Ada, William Maxwell was the fiction editor at The New Yorker for almost 40 years, from 1936 to 1975, almost unheard of by today's standards to be in one job for so long. And he became a close friend of Eudora Welty's, actually. Their correspondence is published in the book, What There Is to Say, We Have Said. They were practically the same age and genuine kindred spirits. There is also, I think, a bit of a feel of Welty in So Long, See You Tomorrow, the book by William Maxwell that you've chosen to discuss for this show as your second choice. The novel is slim and can be read in a day, and I found it rather lonely and haunting. It's essentially about a love triangle murder mystery set in Maxwell's hometown of Lincoln, Illinois. And the narrator was a bystander to the events as a child with a tangential relationship to the case. But he's now much older, and he's looking back on the murder of one man and the suicide of another 50 years after it took place. Ada, tell me why you chose this book.
This is embarrassing for me to admit, but when I chose these books, I did not know that Eudora Welty and William Maxwell were friends or even knew each other. And when I thought about when they were alive and writing, I was like, of course they would have known about each other. And given the kind of writers they were, I'm not surprised that they were friends. It's been so much fun to think about these books in tandem, sort of in conversation with one another, though, of course, it's also striking that to know that the authors were literally in conversation with one another, because there are a lot of similarities between the two books. I chose this book, So Long, See You Tomorrow, because I think in its own way, it's different from Welty's stories. It is also very strange and makes a lot of interesting narrative choices that in a craft class, you might think you can't do that. You can't just start with a first person point of view and then suddenly open up into a distant third person sort of omniscient point of view. But he does it, and it's incredibly seamless. And I think this book is also a book that's about storytelling. You know, about midway in the book, the first person voice kind of just disappears quietly. It just takes on this third person point of view. And then the first person kind of comes back at the very end, just for a few pages. And I think if I can ask, why did Maxwell choose to do that? I think I would say it's because he too is interested in storytelling as a question, why we do it, and what when we can't really make sense of the facts. So in this story, the facts being that there was a murder in town, And the first person narrator who opens the book sort of can't piece it together. So then he has to use his imagination. He has to engage his storytelling brain, you know, that we all naturally have, our yearning for stories to have motive and reason and beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, that beautiful arc that we all love. He sort of applies that to what few facts he does have in order to make sense of this thing that's incredibly difficult to make sense of. And, you know, this is like the fourth time I've read this book, and it just has endless reread value.
You mentioned earlier that Maxwell lost his mother at the age of 10, and I was trying to think about how that experience was evident in this book, and I thought it was very interesting that it's the two men, the two fathers, that die in this book, one murdered, one by suicide. And the women, the mothers, that survive the story, you know, although we see them in some ways kind of tangentially through the interaction of the men, they're quite strong women characters. They were not presented in any way as kind of slavish to the men they had married.
I completely agree. I think it's one of the achievements of the book that Maxwell doesn't make light of any character's life. Every character's life is a full life. They come off as real people with their own desires for their life and their own views of how the reality of their life has fallen short. What really struck me in this reading, that in prior readings I didn't register it as much, it's just the passion that is in this book. It's passion as really a necessity of life. I mean, it's like that fire in the whistle. Jason starts just chucking in the dinner table, and it is, that's passion, you know? It is necessary, you know, it's life-giving, but also can be very destructive. As you see, there are many, many casualties in the passion that takes place between Lloyd and his friend Clarence's wife. But what does Lloyd say at one point? He says to his wife, "I've never been happy in my life. I'm not going to give it up." And he's not saying it cruelly. He's stating a truth. And what happens is just, gosh, it feels like a tragedy, you know, like how, I think everyone's asking, how could this happen? But at the same time, passion, it can't be stopped. And so in a way, when it ends in murder, it feels really unfortunate, but also inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah. Ada, thank you so much for being a guest on this episode of Shelf Life. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today. I really enjoyed these two books that you've chosen as two among your favorites, as well as your own short stories. I can't wait to see what you write next.
Thank you, Aaron. It was such a delight to talk to you, and thank you for inviting me.
You're so welcome. We've been talking about A Curtain of Green by Eudora Welty, published by Harvest Books, and So Long, See You Tomorrow, published by Vintage. Ada Zhong's The Sorrow of Others is published by A Public Space Books. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Brooke Gladstone, Ari Shapiro, and Lydia Millett. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star review to help others find this show?
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Hi, I'm Kusar Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week, Then I'll jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me, The Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
With Morning Edition from NPR News, you don't have to wonder where your information is coming from, because we tell you. Get your news straight from the source every weekday.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.